I think what ended up happening in reality is, like, we went back to our funders and we're like, no, you know, we're not going to, we've decided as a group, you know, collectively, we're not going to take any more foundation grants. And we had some funders who were like, are you sure, you know, we'll fund you for one more year, you know, we'll support, you know, what you're doing, we'll help you, you know, go through the transition. We're like, no, you know, we just want to do it, like, flat out, we're committed, we're ready, we're set. And then we made that decision, and it's been, like, a year and a half now. And we've been, like, sitting with, like, the challenges of doing, of making that decision in such, like, a stark way. And part of what we came up against was, you know, people, just the reality of people needing to live, needing to pay their rent, needing to have some form of health insurance. Even when people were willing to be like, you know what, I'll just get another, you know, I'll get another job and I'll still be part of the collective. Like, they were either taking jobs that, you know, were really draining to them and being a lot of work and not really being able to accommodate and make time for the collective anymore. Or they're taking jobs that, you know, they're taking just to pay their bills. And then that was also draining them, like, just spiritually. And they weren't even in the space to really contribute to a collective. So what ended up happening was, like, a lot of the older woman kind of stepped back and decided to transition out of the collective. And the opportunity that created was for a lot of the young women to kind of step up and create a space where they could, like, contribute to the vision and were willing to take on more leadership. And it also forced us to start thinking about, like, how we could be more collective, not just as an organization, but just, like, with each other. And I think that in, like, getting a lot of our inspiration from, like, third world countries around the world, like, one thing that it's hard to, like, just translate and be like, oh, you know, the Zapatistas did this or the Ogoni people did this. And so, you know, we can, like, take on those practices. It's also realizing, like, a lot of these communities are built in cultures and traditions where they are, like, collectively supporting one another. And so it put us in a space where we're really creative and started thinking about how the side of the project is to do, like, a childcare co-op, you know, and start thinking about, like, you know, just talking more about health and thinking more, like, preventatively and looking, like, alternative ways that we could really, like, support each other around our health, you know, in lieu of, like, health insurance. And then also a lot of the young women were like, you know what, like, I'm interested in like, what it takes to, like, run the organization, like, all the other stuff that we thought was boring. Like, we really see how it's central to us doing the fun stuff that we want to do, and we're willing to, like, learn that and take that on. And it gave us an opportunity to think about how we can, like, decentralize some of this stuff so that it's not just, like, one person who knows how to, you know, do the fundraising or in charge of fundraising. It's something that all collectively we can do. And it had us, like, really get creative, and we're in the space of now thinking, like, how can we, like, really, like, share those tasks so that, you know, everyone can feel like they're part of and they understand how, like, all our systems work. And in the end, like, what it has is, like, even though there's a smaller group of us, I think, like, all of us are all invested in a different way and have, like, a different sense of ownership over the collective and the organization, because we all are going to be playing a role in different areas and just, like, overall how the organization is going to run. And I can think about one example in the video project that we came up with and that the young women have been working on. Before we came up, we had made this decision, but the video project ended up taking, like, a lot longer than we thought that it would, but I think it was actually, like, really powerful and part of what had us, like, keep going and keep, like, wanting to work on and work through the difficulties, because it was a process that young women were really engaged in. And on an individual basis, like, it really transformed the young women that were part of the project. It transformed their lives. But some of them made them, like, realize, like, you know what, I want to go to film school. Like, this is the you know, the media that I want to use, medium I want to use to, like, to do my work. And in terms of, like, and the community and just, like, relationship-wise, it gave us a tool to use to go out and do some of the community education and really, like, building and bringing in, like, getting the message across, like, across the city and bringing in more young women and engaging them around this conversation. And then around, like, structurally, like, it also was a way that we were still, like, doing work to talk about some of the conditions that young women were living in, but it wasn't, like, necessarily taken away, like, from the organizing work that we're doing. Like, the two went hand in hand. And right now, like, we have it as, like, one of our tools for, like, grassroots fundraising. So it's something that we're also selling in the back of the room for $25. And so it just got us, like, thinking about being more creative about ways that we don't, like, necessarily separate, like, okay, this is our organizing work, and then on the other hand, this is our fundraising stuff. But what are some ways that we can do, like, the stuff, have them both go, like, hand in hand? And we're right now, like, working on a project around, like, product making and really, like, incorporating all the different pieces that are important to us. And so for us, like, holistic development is important. So we're coming up with these, like, natural, like, body care lines, and we want them to have themes of, like, revolutionary women, so that it's also a way to continue that dialogue and that conversation in communities and have like some political education. It'll also bring like young women together and build our membership. And it's also a space where informally, like that's where like most of the transformation takes place. And just like sitting and you're talking and you're doing, making the products, where you're also an opportunity to check in and be like, so how are you doing? How's school going? And then in the process, we're going to end up with a product that we can sell and eventually use to like sustain ourselves. So one of the opportunities of like really being in this conversation, like, okay, we're not going to take like foundation grants. So then what are we going to do to be sustainable? It's really had us be creative and like really tap back into our passions and like realize like the organizing and fundraising don't necessarily have to be something separate. It doesn't have to be two different people doing it, but they could actually go hand in hand. And that really, like, it's part of the work of, like, working to, like, empower communities and make people feel like, you know what, we can be accountable. We can really create, like, an autonomous zone. We can really create a space where, like, violence isn't tolerated against women. And part of that is, like, people making that investment, whether it's, like, through $5 or through buying a T-shirt or through buying, like, or just coming together and helping us make some products that we can sell. It's, like, people are personally investing their energy and their time into like building that movement and building that message. And in the long run, we feel like that's what's going to make us more sustainable. And then and really at the same time, also build that community that will be able to like leap in and, you know, have people not have to like work, because we know we can count on each other to look after our kids. We can count on each other to like share meals together. We can count on each other to like, you know, if you need to crash someone's place for like 3 months, then you have, like, we already have those relationships that we'll be building through doing this work. And so I feel like that's really been like one of the benefits of like being in this conversation. And like, while that being said, like, we still are, like, this year, we just found out last week that we got accepted for like our last cycle of our grant with one of the foundations that we decided to continue engaging, that was really like trying to push us to like slow down and like really take our time and be more intentional around our decision to transition from all staff to all volunteer. And so this year we are going to be spending like that time and really like with the commitment, like, okay, this is going to be like the last grant we're going to take, and we're really going to use it to build systems so that, you know, we will be able to be like a stronger collective all volunteer and not run into some of the difficulties that have really been slowing us down and doing the work over the past year.
So we're going to move into the discussion kind of thing, and it's 8:25. We're running a little later than we thought. So, you know, we have it kind of broken down into these three questions up here. Hopefully I'll kind of, you know, check them out a little bit. We wanted to really, like, focus, you know, the event and the discussion in general a lot around the alternatives, right, which is the part that never really quite gets in there as much as the critiques and the analysis of whatever the event is that we're talking about. So, you know, I guess, you know, we're going to kind of facilitate like a discussion, and I, you know, people can maybe try to, you know, just, you know, try to face each other a little bit more than you're facing now. I know it's kind of hard because it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a big room, but folks, you know, can ask questions, you know, and if folks on the panel want to answer it, or definitely if other people in the room, you know, like I was saying, who have experience with these things, you know, want to answer some questions, get kind of a good back and forth. I think one of the things, like, just so that we're not, like, just throwing out, like, you know, mad random questions, like sometimes happens in the question and answer portion, like, if people can try to really, like, intentionally build on other people's questions, try to, like, kind of, like, figure out for yourself, like where the discussion is going, like, when might be like a good time to like ask your question or maybe hold off. And obviously also just like, you know, be mindful of who's speaking and who's not and who's, you know, who's putting their stuff out there and kind of like, you know, respect the space. So before we head into the question and answer, I'm just going to, you know, plug the tables one more time. I know, like, as kind of a younger activist, I know our, you know, our generation has a harder time like thinking about money, and especially like for like, you know, radical movements or whatever, like, oh yeah, you know, I'm sure that they'll, you know, that magazine will keep coming out or that organization will keep existing, like it's all good or whatever, which I think is probably connected in somewhat to the nonprofit kind of complex in all of our minds that the money is always there. But, you know, in reality, it's really not. And we're all kind of just getting supported by, you know, people like you in the space. So definitely check out, you know, Sister Table. I can't recommend enough the Insight CDs out there, which are the recordings from the conference that people have mentioned, 2004. You know, it'll change your life. And then, obviously, the new issue of the magazine, and you get free back issues with every you know, new issue. So, yeah. All right. So, questions. I got you.
I just totally resonate with a lot of what you all are saying. I just thank you for bringing this up and doing this. I live in Gainesville, Florida. I'm involved in Gainesville Women's Liberation and Red Stockings up here in New York. And Red Stockings is a 501c3 that doesn't take grants. So that we've like separated it. In 1973, we incorporated, but we've never gotten grants. In Gainesville Women's Liberation, we also have a school thing that we do, and that's been a way to raise money, really, because not because the students pay enormous tuition, but because at the end we ask them, would you be willing to give us $10 a month? Would you be willing, you know, it's an organizing method. And we realized after writing a few grants that we didn't get, you know, if we just asked everybody we were in contact with who was a feminist for $5 or asked them to give us $10 a month, we would, that's guaranteed money, because if you ask three people, two will give you money. Whereas these grants, you know, you put all this time into it, and then in the end it could be zero, which it always was for us. I mean, almost always. I think we only ever got one grant one time. So I guess one of the answers that we had from our organizing, in what ways does the nonprofit model limit our capacity to affect change, is it focuses you away from the people that should be paying for it into some other group that it doesn't care. So it's like, you know, we want to be answerable to everyday women. That's our mission, right? So how does it relate it to like the grant thing? I guess that was the big thing. And I could go on and on, but I'll let other people talk. Thanks so much.
I have two questions that are different from those three. And one of them is, hasn't the right been pretty successful using the nonprofit model to affect change? And the second one is, how do you make change? Because I think one of you, I can't remember which one, talked about scale. And isn't that the critical piece? How do you achieve scale without bureaucracy? I mean, those are the two issues bubbling up for me.
I think that's a great question. One of the things that we didn't address here, or I didn't address, is that the nonprofit implies, if you really think of it, meditate on the word, it implies a market strategy, right? Because basically, essentially in U.S. political culture, if you want to make change, you make change through the market. And the state regulates, to an extent, how you make that change. So one way is you have to register for a tax ID. In order to make money in this society, in order to be part of the market, you need to be monitored by the state. So hence, the 501c3 is a tax code. And also, if you incorporate your business, you know, the first thing you get is your tax ID number. And the right has been very successful in actually using the latter, using a profit strategy to essentially make inroads, with the exception of the church, right? The church has been a very valuable nonprofit organization for the right. But the impression I get is that the right, to address your question specifically, has been more successful with a for-profit market strategy around how to build its agenda. And the interesting thing that isn't being talked about, though, is that a lot of these progressive foundations, see, we're talking about our problems with the nonprofit as a strategy for change. A lot of progressive foundations are also saying the nonprofit is a dying progressive strategy for change. They're talking about moving to wealth-building strategies. How do we sustain these progressive organizations by having them accumulate wealth? I wish I was lying, but, you know, one of the major texts that a lot of program officers are reading is a book that's called Wealth Building, and it's essentially kind of the standard text for many program officers. So anyway, that's just my kind of quick answer to your question, and I don't know if there's someone in the audience who also wanted to respond to it. I saw a hand go up.
I can offer a perspective on the question and the answer if you like. I agree with your answer. But the left actually has a much more powerful presence in the nonprofit community. As to how
speak up a little, sorry. Sure. People on the other side.
I should disclose myself. I'm a guest of someone who's not here. I've never been here before. I manage a family foundation of reasonable size. I've been on many nonprofit boards in various sectors. So I'm part of the industrial complex you're speaking of. In fact, the left dominates the Council on Foundations, which is the umbrella organization for the foundation industry. To the question of effectiveness and all of that, can't really remember your second question, but I think this might be germane. I think the grassroots organizations that don't take funding and survive on donations from members and friends and that sort of thing, as you guys do, is absolutely terrific, as long as you're effectively accomplishing what you want to accomplish. But going through the difficult burden of applying for grants and receiving grants and putting that money to good use is not to be discounted either. I see nothing wrong with it. It can lead to bureaucracy, often does. It can be self-perpetuating to the people's egos who run a growing, wealth-accumulating nonprofit. But the market, ultimately, if I may, determines the success of a nonprofit. If you've got something to sell, people will give you money, and if you've got good people to do something with the money, you can make good change.
I wanted to say to Sister that what you're doing is really inspiring, and I think very difficult. I've been part of a couple of nonprofits in New York that are small people of color organizations that I think are just dying because they're in the nonprofit structure and don't even have the resources to deal with problems they're coming up with within the organization, let alone all the funding stuff. And I wanted to share a quick story. I worked with a couple of groups in India that are small women's savings groups, and that's a very hot topic in development now, where banks give loans, but this was a different kind of group that refused to take outside funding. So the way they did it would have, they'd have groups of about 10 or 20 women put in what they could, which was ended up being like 10 rupees, which in dollars is like 20 cents a month. So, you know, really poor women. And so each month, one person in the group would take out a loan. They would repay it with very minimal interest rates, like 2% or something. So whatever interest they got, which was a little, not a whole lot of interest, accumulated over a while, that was their wealth accumulation strategy. And after 2 years, they had enough money to hire a staff person to oversee about 400 of these groups. So it had grown that much in 2 years. And it was always amazing to me that I don't know if that would work here or why it doesn't, because I feel like people do give money to, like, church, mosques, like, I don't know. But I think it's really powerful what you're doing. I wish you all.
Quickly, I want to respond. On the issue of, sort of the market or, what have you, I mean, I think there's a fundamental just, I think, disconnect in terms of there are certain kinds of work that I think, like, folks from Sister to Sister specifically talked about that, you know, foundations, and if we talk about them, I guess, as the market, quote unquote, or the, are not going to fund, right? Because they don't understand it, they don't see it. So it's not even about, like, whether or not your work is has any value, but it's value to who? Value to, kind of how they see what you're doing as progress with whatever certain lens or certain measurements that they use. So I think that, it doesn't always kind of jive as easily as that. I think, so a kind of question, I think, for the group, one of the things that, has kind of been, exposed or sort of has been talked about, New Orleans in the wake of Katrina and having lived in New Orleans for a year, And I think it exposes some sort of kind of cultural stuff as a black person born in America around ways in which people organize their lives and space who are completely disconnected from any kind of sustainable work, from, any kind of stuff like that. And so, like, some of the conversations around New Orleans that, have been exposed and folks being separated all these places was how much people really kind of relied on their sort of social networks in order to get stuff that they couldn't get out of the state, right? And you know, then those things exist in even here in New York City, right? There are communities who, even as much as there's sort of funding for nonprofit and social service work, there's definitely spaces and places where people still, you know, have to rely to some extent on whatever social networks they have to kind of get stuff done. And so how, it's like a question I guess I have is how do we also begin to think about, you know, our work in the context of the kind of existing organic, you know, structures and social networks and communities, you know, in order to do certain stuff or to make certain stuff happen. And sometimes some of that organizing stuff is full of fucked up shit, right? Some of the kind of, you know, organization of underground, you know, drug dealings, you know, sex work or stuff like that isn't necessarily fucked up just in and of itself, but kind of the other sort of layers of stuff that it creates. So how do we tap into existing structures to do work?
Yeah, I had two things to say kind of in response to this whole discussion. But first, I just wanted to say I'm really, really, you know, just overwhelmed by the young people who are here. Who are questioning this nonprofit thing. I'm overwhelmed by Sister to Sister. And I think what Insight did, you know, to start this whole ball rolling a few years ago was really something which was long overdue. And I think in terms of what the gentleman over there was saying, I mean, I think we need to go back to what was the theme of the Insight conference, which is it was the revolution will not be funded, not social change will not be funded. And, I mean, Eric, you wrote a brilliant article. But there was one point that I, you know, just wanted to clarify from my perspective, which was, you know, it was not the bad 60s when you said, you know, 68. Okay. The bad 60s was the period of time from 68 through 71 when the Black Panther Party was strongest, from 69 through 72 when we had the largest anti-war mobilizations, from 67 on when Martin Luther King made his famous, you know, speech where he realized that you cannot talk about civil rights outside of a global context of the war in Vietnam. And what was happening in the bad 60s, as they are called, was that was the point when people realized that you had to transcend a single issue and you had to really, and that you had to fail, you know, that basically it was not about changing little issues anymore, but it was about creating an appetite among our people and connecting together and to say we've got to change something which is so big that we're going to keep on failing until we finally get together. And now I go up to 125th Street and the Harlem Tenants Council with Nellie Hester Bailey is being told by their funders, you know, you're talking about liberation, you're getting off your issue. You know, and I think, and the problem is that people were saying the same thing to Martin Luther King. The foundation thing did not start in the 80s. It started in the 60s when they had when David Rockefeller founded the Trilateral Commission with Henry Kissinger and the people from the Ford Foundation and Jimmy Carter, and they developed a strategy. They anticipated globalization. And, you know, and basically in terms of the damage it's done to the movement, it's really incredible. Because you look at social change in the last few years, the biggest student protests in the history of this country were done by CUNY students in 89 and 91, and not a single bit of it was funded. When people rise up in anger, you know, in a mass movement, you're not going to have a time to write a grant and to go through a funding cycle, and you're not going to want to do it. It's going to be completely irrelevant to that sort of thing. The part of your article, Eric, that I wish you had mentioned, you know, was the part where Cesar Chavez talked about the importance of dues. You know, I mean, most of us will go to a movie or buy a CD or buy a DVD, you know, even in the poorest, you know, communities. You know, we have to own our movements. We have to be free to do the things that we think our people need. You know, we have to have that dialogue. I was in one organization where the Young Bloods were on my board and we went through a funding. We got some funding. And we went through the process that was described so eloquently by Sister to Sister. And people saw, you know, you become the flavor of the month. You do, you know, they want you to do cocktail parties, and pretty soon you have, you know, really great organizers, great young people out in the Hamptons or up on the Upper East Side trying to convince people to write a check so we could hire a staff. And then when the staff has to go home, you know, well, the movement shuts down, you know, because, you know, staff's got to go home. I mean, you know, the movement is based upon volunteers. Now, the highest levels, you know, groups like the Black Panthers, was just everybody just put everything into a pot. And that was how it was done. But what I'm trying to say is that when you realize that you have to decide if your goal is to make social change around a specific issue, if that's your ultimate goal, or if that is a way of opening people up to seeing the need toward, you know, a transformation of society that will never be funded. So, but I think the dues-paying model, the sort of, not the wealth building, but the kind of entrepreneurial model that the Sisters is really operating under, where your money is your own and is the movement's own, and you don't have to basically go through, and the government is not looking at you. And yet, the last thing I'm going to say is a movement has got to be transparent to the people we are organizing, but opaque to the people who are, you know, who are, let's say it, our enemies, the enemies. I mean, there is an enemy when you're doing so, if you're going to be really doing this thing in a serious manner. And when you get into the 501c3 milieu, it gets all mixed up, you know.
So I had two people on the stack. They're both men. I'm gonna take a question right there, then I'm going to go to Duda, and then right here, Mike, and then I got Paula after that.
One of the things that was talked about, I think, by all of you was kind of like a push for women and people of color into the nonprofit model. I'd like to talk about that a little bit more, especially because it seems to me that like there's always a push for us to validate ourselves to a lot of people, and in that sense, making it seem as if the work that we do is as serious to kind of like a normalized model of what serious is, and trying to do good work for ourselves and for our people, we move away to what other funders or organizations seem interpret as good work. And so I just like for us talk a little bit more about that. Maybe sister to sister, talk about like how you did have to play that game of when you were seeking funding, and then now that you're getting out of it, it just seems like that would be a really big like weight off your back. But also, what kind of response have you gotten from your community, not just the young women that you work with, but also the young men of color that you work with, who like are looking for profit, right? Like a lot of the young people that I work with are like, I want to go to college to make money, and to like money to get out of the projects, to feed myself and all this stuff. And so like, how has your model been perceived to the people that you're trying, by the people that you're trying to reel in? And also, I don't know if that example that you were talking about before, about going to the barber shop and like confronting an abusive partner and confronting his coworkers and stuff, I don't know if that was a real example, but how the young men in your community in Bushwick responded.
About the young men. I mean, we've had a long, long thing around working with young men, and I don't know if people want to get into it, but
yes.
Okay. We think it's important, but we're not doing that work. I mean, we've had things from a period where we get a lot of like bottles thrown at us and like bitch written on the, you know, on the gates, or like young men coming in like, what is this, you know, lesbians all up in here, why is no guys, you know, and just a lot of aggression towards having a visible space where there were no men. And so we get faxes, you old fucking lesbian bitches, this and that. You know, we get these crazy faxes that would never stop. Like, so it's been an issue, you know. And then we went through a period where we were thinking about, well, that was just like a lot of community, you know, sexism and heterosexism that is in all of us, you know, and that was just being manifested by some young men. And we thought about, like, creating spaces for young men. And what we did is we convened a few meetings with some young men and older male activists. And actually, Richie Perez was one of them who came to a series of meetings that we had. And some young men that we knew who were activists or organizers from the neighborhood, Alex was one of them, and kind of talked to them about, as we're doing the strategy, like, maybe y'all can try to do some stuff and we can be in partnership and we'll give you space, copy machine, whatever you want, but, like, we're not going to be the ones to, like, organize and do freedom schools for young men. But, like, here's the doors open. We'd be so down if you do it. And it didn't happen, you know, for whatever reason. You know, they were all busy doing other things politically. And we haven't found that many men who see it as their first priority political work to, like, work on sexism stuff. You know, even really cool men are, a lot of times there's so many other things that they're working on and facing that is real. I'm not trying to, you know, diss, but like we had a while we were working with a group of men of color against sexism, and they were meeting, and maybe some people in here were part of it. I know Eric was part of it, and it was really a cool thing, and we were trying to figure out how to work with each other, and they wanted to do a fundraiser for us, and it just was like too much too fast, and they really just needed time to build and deal with their own stuff, you know, because as men, before you go out and kind of challenge other men, there's a lot of stuff inside that you got to deal with, and I think maybe we were pushing them too much and they just needed to be. So it hasn't happened, but have we made an impact on the young men in the neighborhood? Like, yeah, we don't have people throwing bottles anymore, we don't have that level of disrespect. We have more people kind of recognizing that the space is valuable and cool. And we do have young men coming in and out, with his friends, boyfriends, brothers, and who are cool, you know. And we've had gatherings that have been about visioning what to do with violence without turning to the cops. Like, what are other ways? And a lot of young men were involved in those conversations.